Hi guys, it's me, Lindsay Pinchuk, host of Dear Found Her. So I had an interesting conversation with a client this week that I wanted to share with you. It was about knowing your worth. She recently had raised her prices and she was nervous about the change. But I explained to her that she needs to be getting paid for her experience and not selling herself short. And that she just had to be confident in putting these new rates out into the world. So I shared with her that almost every single one of my students in the founding cohort of my Marketing Made Simple mentorship program has shared with me that they would be willing to pay me double for what they're getting inside my community and mentorship. And so guess what? I did raise the price. Now, I didn't double it, but it's definitely gone up from when these initial women joined late last year. But with that also comes a level of involvement to you, my clients, that you're getting from me. I've added a fourth monthly call for members inside, as well as upcoming workshops with outside experts and more opportunities to work with me one-on-one to build and grow your own business. Marketing Made Simple for Small Business is a group mentorship program for women-owned businesses. You'll work to create effective content, messaging, and a marketing process to connect with your community, build awareness, and drive sales. This is a program that combines small group strategy sessions, one-on-one Q&A and accelerator calls, community support, and a ton of digital resources designed to give you the step-by-step instructions and guidance that you need for brand growth. Our spring cohort of Marketing Made Simple for Small Business is open, and you can still get in before the end of the month. We have an amazing group of women who have already started, and they can't wait to meet you too. Now, even though I've raised the pricing on Marketing Made Simple, I'm giving Dear Found Her listeners an exclusive discount. All you have to do is use the code FOUNDHER for 20% off at checkout. Plus, with this discount, I've added an amazing bonus, a second one-on-one accelerator call with me on all new annual memberships. And if you've already enrolled in the spring cohort, don't worry, you'll get this too. If you have any questions, simply DM me at Lindsay Pinchuk or email me at lindsay@lindsaypinchuk.com. You can click the link in the show notes for more information or to join our spring cohort of Marketing Made Simple for Small Business. And now, on to the show. After college, Gail Simmons wrote down the words, eat, write, travel, cook. And with that, she manifested her own destiny. In today's conversation, you're going to hear exactly how this happened. Gail Simmons is a trained culinary expert, food writer, and dynamic television personality. Since the show's inception in 2006, she's lent her extensive expertise as a permanent judge on Bravo's Emmy-winning series, Top Chef. Gail is the co-founder of Bumble Pie Productions and sits on the board of several other nonprofit organizations, including Children in Conflict, City Harvest, and Hot Bread Kitchen. As you'll hear me talk about in a moment, I was lucky enough to recently spend the day with Gail, and I'll tell you, her normalcy and humble demeanor are two of the many reasons why I wanted to have her on the show today. So please come on in and meet the one and only Gail Simmons. Dear Found Her, I'm your host, Lindsay Pinchuk. At 30 years old, I founded my first company with just $500, building it to reach 3 million people and generate seven figures in revenue for 6 years straight, all before I sold it. A decade later, I exited with one goal: to support other women in business through their own entrepreneurship journeys. As an entrepreneur, you wear every hat. You burn the midnight oil, and most of all, you pour your heart and soul into everything you do. But there's no blueprint for success. Every week on Dear Found Her, you'll get to sit in as I pick the brain of some of my closest female founder contacts. Save yourself time, money, and hassle listening to the lessons of those who have already done it. You'll also have the chance to hear about my own founder journey, how I built my first company, and now how I'm building my second, as I share solo episodes filled with actionable lessons and steps that you can apply to your business immediately. Make sure to subscribe now so that we can build our businesses together each and every week. Now, let's get into today's episode. Welcome back to another episode of Dear Found Her. I am so excited about today's guest because I was recently lucky enough to spend the day in New York City with her. Gail Simmons and I met through our mutual friends. For years, they've been trying to connect us, knowing that we would hit it off immediately. Gail and her husband are both Jewish and Canadian, like my husband, and I am now half Canadian too. And so the connections were flowing from the moment that we met. And I want to make it known that spending the day with Gail Simmons is truly like spending the day with any one of your friends. except she is a culinary expert and a judge on Bravo's Top Chef. So when we walked into the restaurant for lunch, there were definitely a lot of heads that turned. I am thrilled that Gail has agreed to join me today to take us behind the scenes on how she's become one of the most recognized culinary experts of our time. So Gail Simmons, welcome to Dear Founder.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here with you.
I'm so glad that we're doing this. This is long overdue.
It is.
I would love for you to start us off by taking us back. I know that you started your food journalism career at Vogue, but you were an anthropology and Spanish major at McGill. So how did you end up in this space?
Really by accident, I think. Not so much by accident, but serendipitously, I should say. It was never a plan. I had a loose plan for my life, but I'd be lying if I said that what I'm doing now is what I set out to do 20 years ago. I think life takes you on a bit of a roller coaster, and I was lucky enough to find myself in the right place at the right time at moments in pop culture where there were opportunities, and I was able to sort of like walk through those doors. And I feel really lucky about it. I started out in Canada, grew up in Toronto, and went to McGill for university. I really had no idea what to do with my career when I was graduating. And at the time, I actually felt really lousy about it. Most of my girlfriends, I have this amazing group of girlfriends in Canada. You know, it's sort of a unique thing, I think, at least to where I'm from, compared to where I live now in New York, where I have this group of women, girlfriends in my life, many of whom have been in my life since we were born or since we were 3 years old or elementary school. And we all grew up together in the true sense of the word, from preschool through elementary, high school. Many of us then, you know, picked up and you know, re-met or kind of expanded that group through summer camp, through college. So when I was graduating college, there was this group of, let's say, 40 women. And I'm still in touch with all of them and close to really so many of them. And they all knew exactly what they wanted to do by the time they graduated college. And this was really foreign to me because I had no idea. And I didn't understand how all of my friends were so certain about their futures. And by and large, all the things they all set out to do, they're still doing. Doctors and lawyers and, you know, working for big banks or tech companies or being dentists or social workers or fighting social justice. Like, they're all doing it. And they knew 25 years or more ago that they wanted to do it. I, on the other hand, did not. All I knew is that I loved to write and I loved to cook. I had started cooking when I was in college, sort of my last year of college in earnest, and when I had my own apartment, and I would haul my mom's recipes back when I would go home for the weekends, and I borrowed her food processor. And my mother was an amazing cook. So I sort of came by that interest, honestly. She actually was a food writer. She wrote a column for the Globe and Mail when I was growing up, which is Canada's biggest paper. She had a food column. And she taught cooking out of our kitchen to the women in the neighborhood and sometimes the men, which in the 80s when I was growing up was actually a really big deal, that she did a dad's cooking class. And it was very forward thinking at the time. She was just a self-taught, really inventive, spontaneous cook. And she loved that she had access to such great ingredients in Toronto. So she would, growing up, schlep us to Chinatown for, you know, all the fruits and vegetables there, or she would schlep us to the little Portuguese village to buy meat or fish. And so she was really a bit of a trailblazer in that sense. But of course, when you're a child and even into young adulthood, looking at your parents, you can't really see that value, right? And the last thing I wanted to do was be just like my mother. So I started writing, right? I mean, who wants to be like their mother, right? I do now. I'm very proud of it. But at the time, it was like the last thing on my mind. I started writing restaurant reviews my last year of college for the McGill Tribune, you know, the student paper, not ever thinking it was a career. I actually just thought it was sort of fun on a lark. I wasn't getting paid to do it. It was just writing experience. And it was a chance to just explore Montreal, which is an incredible food city. And it gave me a chance to sort of get out of the McGill student quarter and explore some of the more interesting sort of ethnic cuisines that Montreal had to offer. And there are many: Vietnamese, Peruvian, Haitian, Thai, Vietnamese, just, you know, so many great places in Montreal to check out. So I wrote those articles and then I graduated college and I had no idea what to do. And I went back home to Toronto and all my friends started the next chapter of their lives. And I was like in my parents' basement, depressed. And finally, one of the family friends of my parents' daughter, who was actually a television producer and went on to become a really big television producer at Food Network in Canada, actually, but at the time was just starting to produce television, told me that I should just write down on a piece of paper what I loved to do. And I should stop stressing so much about like what jobs there are out there, because I was like so fixated on finding my career. And on this piece of paper, I wrote down eat, write, travel, cook. And she was like, okay, so let's do it. Let's figure it out. That you know what you want to do. You just have to figure out how to get there. And sort of off I went. It was the first time I was given permission to pursue these interests that until then I had thought weren't good enough, I guess, because they weren't academic. You know, I came from a really sort of conservative, like academic background. All my friends were going to post-secondary, you know, maybe postgraduate degrees, things like that. And I landed an internship at a magazine in Toronto and then at a newspaper. And at both places, I kept sort of following around the food critic and the food editor. I was writing as much as I could. I was really learning about publishing and about print journalism. I was fact-checking and doing research for them. And eventually, about a year into the process of working in Toronto in print for this magazine and then this newspaper, I started getting the chance to do some writing, food writing, little pieces here and there, 25 and under reviews, ingredients or taste tests, things like that. And I went to my editor at the time and said, okay, this is it. Like, I know what I want to do. I want to be a food editor. I want to be a food writer. What's my next step? And he said, this is kind of a theme in my life, I think, mentors giving me very honest and sometimes abrasive advice that I had to really dig down to not get upset about, but realize they were right.
And that's a good mentor.
It is, absolutely. And he said, you don't know anything about food. How can you write about a subject that you're not an expert in? If you're really serious about food, if that's your beat, so to speak, you got to get on the front lines. You got to learn to cook. You need to be able to speak the language of the kitchen, because right now you're a 23-year-old kid who likes to eat. You don't really know anything about the subject. It's like being a political reporter. You can't do it from your couch, right? You can't just expect to be an expert just because you think it's fun. You need to really go get your degree in it. Go study it. And then you'll be taken seriously. Also, there's so much competition, especially in Canada. There was only like 4 or 5 food writing jobs in English-speaking Canada. And so how was I, a 23-year-old, going to compete against these veteran food writers who were never leaving their jobs? And more than that, all of the big food writing was all taking place in New York, right? It was still the capital of print publishing. That's where all the glossy food magazines were. That's where all the big newspapers were coming out of, and all the major food content at the time. Because remember, I'm old, so this is like dawn of the internet, but it's pre-blogs. It's definitely pre like online food culture. It's way before the Eaters and the Infatuations and the Grub Streets, and it's before social media. So when I think of the fact that I wanted to be in food media, that really just meant print. So I took what he said to heart and I quit the job and I moved in with one of my best friends from summer camp growing up, who was living in New York. And he let me rent out his literal closet to sleep in while I enrolled in full-time culinary school. And that was sort of the beginning of getting my feet wet and understanding what it meant to be a cook.
One of the things that I love that you just said is you manifested this destiny for yourself. You said, I wrote down, you know, eat, write, travel, cook. And that is what you're doing. And of course it took a while to get there, but like any entrepreneur who's listening to this podcast, you created your own destiny and you've created your own brand. It's your personal brand. And I love that about your story. And there were, I mean, of course, I've read so much about you and I know about you, but I love hearing that in your own words. And so thank you for going that far back and sharing that.
It's funny. Yeah, no, I agree. And it's one of those pieces of information that in hindsight, when someone else like you or, you know, someone listening to the story can see the full picture, it's easy to see. At the time, I assure you, like anyone starting their own business, or, you know, and let me assure you, I was not trying to start my own business at the time, right?
I was trying to figure out what to do.
I was like, I just need a job. I need someone to pay me. And I kind of just want to like it. And I know I can't be a lawyer. I knew that that was not my destiny. And so, you know, I was just trying to sort of dream big, I guess. And now I see that so clearly. But let me assure you, Lindsay, at the time I did not, which was a great piece of the story.
And you also said that, you know, this was all by accident and there was never really a plan. And that are those are two traits also that many entrepreneurs share when they're sharing their stories is like, right. No one really has a plan, right? So you go to culinary school and you learn how to cook and you learn the language and you learn to walk the talk and talk the walk and all the things. And then how do you land at Vogue?
Right. So the thing that I'm sure won't come as a surprise to anyone, but is worth stating is that you go to culinary school, you're not a chef. When you graduate from culinary school, you are not a chef. Lots of young culinary graduates think they are, but let me assure you, they are not. They are cooks. They have a foundation. It's like saying the day you graduate medical school that you can like perform open heart surgery, right? You are not there yet. You've done everything theoretically. You've learned the foundation. You know the anatomy, but no one is giving you a scalpel and just saying, go to it, right? You need to get hard experience, which is why I'm using the medical metaphor just while we're here, which is why you do residencies, right, in medical school. Well, the same applies to the kitchen. You need to do apprenticeships. You need to start at the bottom. Even though I had just finished this full year of culinary immersion and education in New York, which was an amazing, extraordinary experience. I loved culinary school. It was like food camp. But I still was not a chef. I had done everything once, right? And I knew the theory, like, yes, I could recite to you what were in the mother sauces. That doesn't mean I could make them perfectly for 80 people on the line at night in the middle of service, right? So I went back to my career services director who was helping us play, you know, they were placing us in these apprenticeships that we had to do to finish school. And in my head, I was like, great, I've done culinary school. I can just go and get a job at one of these glossy magazines that's what I want to do is my apprenticeship. I want to get placed in media and go to like the test kitchen at Gourmet magazine or Food and Wine magazine. And I'd be off and running. I would do that for a few months and then I'd go back to Toronto and get one of those big glamorous jobs that I had dreamed about being I could now be like a big fish in a small pond. And when I went to them to describe what I wanted to do for my apprenticeship, they sort of laughed and they were like, that sounds great, but we really have to say that what we think you should do is go cook. Go to a restaurant. You still don't have the skills, right? You might have the language. You're talking the talk, but you're not yet walking the walk. And they convinced me instead of doing an apprenticeship at a magazine to do real cook jobs. And that was amazing advice too, because I couldn't see it and I wasn't part of the plan. I was like, why do I need this? I know I don't want to be a chef. I want to write about it. But I understood that I had more to learn. So I was placed in a really overwhelmingly large, fancy kitchen, Le Cirque 2000, which at the time was one of the 4-star restaurants in America, a really exceptional, legendary magazine. And I kind of bit off more than I could chew in some ways by choosing that job as a place to cook. I was the only woman on the line. It was a massive, massive kitchen. It was an open kitchen, so we could watch the diners and they could see us. It was a very traditional, you know, Western European male-dominated place with the toques and the very complex sauces. But it was a great education, and I worked there for a little while. And then I left there and went to another kitchen called Vong, which is... it doesn't exist anymore. It's Jean-Georges Vongerichten, also one of the greatest chefs alive cooking today. he had this amazing Thai concept. There was one in Chicago for a while too, actually. And Vong was really one of the first of its kind. Fine dining, 3-star New York Times, exceptional ingredients and technique, all with Thai flavors. And it was a much smaller kitchen. I was still the only woman, but it was an amazing place to work because I was just exposed to ingredients and flavors and combinations and cooking techniques that I would never have otherwise learned staying in that sort of very Western style kitchen. So I went there for a while. I loved cooking there, but after a while I started getting that itch. You know, it's time for me to go back to that dream of publishing. That hadn't changed. It also really solidified for me that I didn't want to be a chef. Watching my fellow cooks every night, it sort of made me realize that being a cook is really a manual, physical job. You're not using your creativity. I mean, it takes like 10 years to become a chef, the way it takes 10 years to really become an expert in anything, right?
Well, I think too, sometimes like doing the thing makes you realize that you don't want to do the thing and solidifies what it is that you want to do. And you knew what you wanted to do. And it helped solidify that.
And it absolutely did. But it also made me understand and have reverence for the kitchen and the people who do it. Because all my fellow cooks on the line were all aspiring to be chefs one day. And they were all in their first, second, third, fourth, fifth year of doing so. And when you're cooking as a line cook, before you make it to the sous chef level where you can actually start being creative, start creating your own dishes and getting them on the menu and shaping the dining experience, you're really just a soldier. You know, you are executing. You're peeling the carrots. You're doing the exact same work every night. And there's not a lot of mental, I mean, it's a mentally taxing job because there's precision involved, but you're not exercising any creative skills. And I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted to be creative that way. Meanwhile, I'd been living in my friend's closet still. And I would come, you know, you work very weird hours as a cook. All my friends had normal jobs. So they were, you know, working and their life went from like 8 a.m. till 10 o'clock at night. My life went from noon until 1 a.m. So I'd come home when everyone was sleeping and I would just read. I would pick up and read any book about food I could get my hands on. And I found, or I was given, I wish I remember who gave it to me at the time, this book called The Man Who Ate Everything, which was written, award-winning book by the food critic at Vogue magazine. And I had never read Vogue and I had no interest in Vogue because I had no interest in fashion, but he was this extraordinary writer. And I realized once I started reading the book that he was the dream. Not that I wanted to be him because he cannot be replicated. He's like a national treasure, Jeffrey Steingarten, one of the greatest long format food journalists like ever to live. But in the book, he talks about his assistant and how one day she's at the green market and the next day she's scouring Chinatown for a very specific piece of cooking equipment. And the next day she's at the New York Public Library researching some ingredient. And it just felt like the job. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to immerse myself in the food world. I wanted to work for someone as talented as this man. He was such a brilliant writer and researcher. So I went back to my career services department and I said, do you know this book? Like, this guy's amazing. And he has all these incredible assistants and they all seem like young women, sort of my age. I want to do something like that. And I kid you not, my career services director said to me, I just saw him and he's looking for a new assistant. And that was sort of it. That didn't mean I got the job, but I interviewed and I was working for him within about a week. It was the hardest interview of my life still to this day. I don't know why he gave me the job. You know, I thought I'd failed miserably when I walked out of there. He is a very challenging person to work for, but I worked for him for 2 years doing all of those things at Vogue. And it was the greatest education of my life.
I was going to say, it was probably the best education ever that you could have received.
Absolutely. In a million ways. I mean, I met every major chef and food person in New York City and beyond. He traveled the world. At the time, he had no budget. Anna Wintour would just kind of give him carte blanche to do anything he wanted. This was in the era of The Devil Wears Prada. Actually, at the time that I was working for Jeffrey, the assistant who was Anna's assistant was the woman, was Lauren, who wrote Devil Wears Prada. And her senior assistant, like the person above her, was my good friend from summer camp growing up in Toronto. So we, you know, there was this sort of like big crew of assistants who were all just making it happen for the higher ups. And that was very much the culture. Although I was at arm's length from the fashion side of things because I was working just alongside Jeffrey.
Hi guys, it's Lindsay Pinchuk, host of Dear Founder. As entrepreneurs, you wear so many hats, don't you? Sometimes it's hard to know how and when and who to hire for help. But I want to say finding Hivecast to produce my podcast has been a godsend. They've been producing Dear Founder since season one, and honestly, I'm not sure what I'd do without them. Each week, I give them everything that they need to create the episodes that you hear. And not only do they produce and put out the episode, but they create all the awesome marketing materials that you see to promote it. They save me so much time, and honestly, their rates don't break the bank. What I love about them is that they make podcasting accessible to any small business owner who wants to create a podcast. I know that many of you have reached out to them already, but I just want to say, if you're thinking about a podcast of your own, reach out to the Hivecast team. I promise they will make it seamless from the start. You can find them through the link in the show notes. And now back to the episode. So let's fast forward to Top Chef. Obviously, that's where you are today, but you have been there since the start. And how did that break take place? What happened? How did you get that?
Well, there was like 5 years in between. The short of it is that I left Jeffrey and I went to work for a chef named Daniel Boulou, big fancy French man, and I was doing his marketing and PR. And at that moment, it actually occurred to me that maybe I don't want to work in writing because writing is really lonely. And I had worked with Jeffrey and it was very isolating at times. And as much as I loved food writing, when I went to work for Daniel, I was doing marketing and PR. I was helping him write his books, doing all kinds of things for him. And I learned that that side of the business of restaurants really fascinated me. And that was a kind of a different education because that was about running a restaurant empire. And there were book projects and press appearances and special events and charity. And I opened restaurants with him. And I did all these kinds of things and I loved it. And after 3 years there, I was approached by Food & Wine magazine to go work with them. And I didn't even know what I was going to be doing for them, but I just took the job because finally that was the moment, right? Food & Wine was what I'd been kind of subconsciously hoping for all along, to finally put all the things I'd learned at Jeffrey and Danielle and culinary school towards a print publication. And I went to Food & Wine in 2004. And within a few months of getting the job, the woman who was running the Food & Wine Classic in Aspen, which was their biggest event of the year, left to have twins and didn't return after her maternity leave. So I was moved into that role. So I started running this festival, which was fantastic. Again, a bit of a departure from being a writer and editor at the magazine, but I got to work with every chef. I got to run this incredible festival and all was great. I'd made it. Like that was the dream job. And I was happy doing that. And I was at Food & Wine and I loved the people and I was close with all the editors. And it was just such an amazing time in print food media. Like, you know, it was like kind of the best moment before everything changed and kind of changed because of me, not because of me, but I was definitely, you know, one of the factors. It, you know, I was part of that change. About a year into my job running the Classic, our publisher got a call from Bravo saying, "We just finished the show Project Runway. It's all about finding the next young talents in fashion. We want to roll it out across the other sort of categories of things that we do. The next world is food, but we don't know anything about food. So would you partner with us on the show? Would you teach us about chefs and about talent and about the world of cooking? And in exchange, and maybe give us some of the prize, give the winner of, you know, of this competition a prize that is related to Food & Wine. And in exchange, if we like one of your editors, we'll put them on the show to represent Food & Wine at the judges table." And because I had done so much PR for Danielle, and because I had the cooking experience from my cooking time and my culinary degree, I had started doing a little bit of media for the magazine, you know, tiny little news segments when they needed someone to do a cooking demo for a spring recipe or whatever, like a wine trend story in the news, like New York One or the Today Show, Good Morning America, that kind of stuff. So they came to me and said, "Why don't we try this out? you know, the idea of a magazine being on television was really unknown at the time, and it would expose them to a massive new audience. So they sent me for a screen test at Bravo at 30 Rock. And I remember actually being horrified because I didn't know what that was. And I had no aspirations to be on television. There wasn't any food competition television at the time, except Iron Chef Japan. And then the Food Network, which was really chefs cooking. And so there was no precedent. And in my head, I was like, this could be a horrifying, terrible, like reality television sounds like a terrible idea. It's like Survivor and Fear Factor. Which wasn't a good reference to like explain to my parents what I was doing in New York City. So I went for the screen test, and 3 weeks later they called and said, all right, we're making the show and we'd love Gail to come and be the representative of Food and Wine. And they flew me to San Francisco and we did the first season, and it was like a total social experiment. We didn't really know what we were doing. There was nothing else like it. We trusted Bravo and we loved the production company, the Magical Elves, who still make our show. And Tom Colicchio, as the head judge, we trusted implicitly because he worked so closely with Food and Wine over the years. And I actually knew him from my years working for Jeffrey. So we knew that there was a moral compass there, that it wasn't going to be Fear Factor in the food world. But who knows how it would be received. I came back from that first season, went back to my job running the Classic in Aspen, and sort of thought nothing of it. And it was only when it didn't gain traction immediately. They aired the full first season twice on Bravo before it started picking up speed. And then when we were renewed for a second season was when it sort of occurred to me, this was something, this was a thing. And by the end of the second season, we were on the front page of the New York Times, and it was like never, ever in our purview. So that was 2006, and I've been doing it ever since.
So when was it that you kind of like, you were not a Food and Wine editor anymore?
Right.
Because that was, that's obviously you don't do that anymore. And you are on Top Chef.
I'm my own person. Yes.
Yes.
I do other things too. Right.
Yes,
I have my own
course.
Company. You know, that transition took a long time because again, there was no precedent for it. I did 4 seasons of Top Chef as a full-time employee of Food and Wine magazine. I still had my other full-time job. I had a team of 5 in New York and 3 in Aspen who I was desperately trying to manage and work with to do my other job. And this was still very much like extracurricular on top of everything because none of us thought it was going to keep happening. And we were sort of waiting for it to go away, not go away, but
the other
die down.
Drop.
Yeah. And so I kept just doing my other job. And it was only in the 4th season, which we shot in Chicago in like 2009, I've lost track a little bit, did it occur to me, this is untenable. Like I can't do both jobs because not only was now Top Chef taking up so much of my time, and we were starting to shoot twice a year, which is why we've made 21 seasons in 18 years. So we were shooting twice a year. And then when the show was on the air, I was doing tons of press for the show. And then on top of it, all these other things were happening to me. I was offered a book deal and a column from the Wall Street Journal and offered to be on other television shows and do other like products. And all these things were happening. And as long as I was an employee of the magazine, I wasn't allowed to do any of that. So I went to my publisher and thought like, what can we, let's find a solution because I love Food and Wine. It's my home. I'd now been there 5 years. And I wanted to figure out a way I could do the job, but also do all these other things and let this take me where it would, because I knew there was major opportunities happening. And so we created a situation where I was a consultant. I became my title became special projects director, but ultimately I was like the editor at large. And that relationship, so I was doing, I could now be a consultant. I was a mostly full-time contractor to the magazine, but I could also do all the other things because I wasn't an employee, and I could work with them and still stay on the show. And that relationship lasted another 10 years. I only truly left Food and Wine as a consultant, sort of as the editor at large in 2019. Because by then I was doing a video series for them. I was writing a column, but I had also written my own 2 books, done several other television shows, spinoffs of Top Chef, and was, you know, running a company of my own. And in 2019, there were major changes in the publishing world, and it felt just like I didn't really need to be there anymore. Food and Wine is still connected to the show, but I remain on as my own individual person now.
Gail, I mean, I said, I knew a lot about you, but I didn't know a lot of this. And I just want to go back to what you said in the beginning, because you said before you started your career, I want to cook, I want to write, I want to travel, I want to eat. And that is exactly what you are doing. And so
it is,
you know, I want you to take a moment and just like be like, oh my God, like I am doing everything that I ever wanted to do, because that's remarkable.
It's true. And I could have never scripted it had I tried, which is, I think, how these things happen, right? Yes. If I had tried to plot out how to do those things, I could have never predicted media. I could have never predicted technology. I could have never predicted food in the zeitgeist, right? Food in popular culture and how that would change and evolve and how Top Chef would really be part of that conversation. I could have never imagined, even when we started doing Top Chef in that first season, that we would make 21 seasons, we're already prepping for season 22, and how enormous the impact of the chefs on our show would be to dining in America. And they, you know, 300 plus restaurants have opened by our former contestants at this point. So it sounds a little bit dramatic, but it is true that our reality show, of any reality show in any genre, has had more economic impact on its industry. Ultimately, you know, the barrier to entry to doing an album or launching a fashion line is much greater than opening a restaurant, but that's why it's worked so well. I mean, if you think about Project Runway, everyone can maybe name the winners, but can you tell me what 10 of those winners are doing right now, besides perhaps Christian Siriano and a handful of others? And can you... You know, even American Idol, obviously there's Kelly Clarkson and Jennifer Hudson. There's a handful, but they all did not go on. And I'm not just talking about winners in Top Chef. In fact, I'm largely not talking about winners, although all our winners are extraordinary. But I would say the top six of every season, and way more as well, have all gone on to win our industry's top awards, open restaurants, start their own shows. I mean, we joke, but Top Chef is basically a casting agency for the Food Network at this point. You know, that like Tournament of Champions just ended. And I think 99% of the contestants on it are former Top Chef competitors. So we created a kind of an industry.
And it's remarkable. And,
but I say that because I'm in awe of it too. It was never the goal necessarily. It was never what we set out to do, but we are certainly very proud of having done it.
So you alluded a couple minutes ago, you know, you said I have other projects and I am me and whatnot. You do have your own company, Bumble Pie. And
yes.
I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, because I think it's important for people to understand how you grew fast and big and that you were being pulled in a lot of different directions. And it's important to rein it in and have a place to streamline those revenue streams, whether it's you as a person or a company who has multiple revenue streams on products. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about that.
It is the same. You know, it took me a while to be able to call myself a business owner and an entrepreneur. It took other people telling me that for me to like be okay with it and to have confidence when I said it out loud. I actually have two companies. One is sort of my private, the company of me. So when you see me on television or when I write a book and it's just my own self representing myself to the world on television or, doing speaking appearances or writing book projects or whatever. And then I have a second company, Bumble Pie, which you alluded to, which is a content company, a production company where I am not in front of the camera. That is the company I founded with a partner in 2014 or 2015 to create projects for other women mostly and other people to explore lesser heard voices in the culinary space. And also to give ourselves control over the work that we do so that, you know, otherwise when I'm in front of the camera, I am just, you know, I'm just the talent, but when I can produce and when I can then control it, it allows me, first of all, to make the projects that I want to see in the world and to fight for the project I think are important and the topics and the people and the talent. And it also expands that culinary pool And allows me to have a lot more control over my personal life. I'm not just at the whim of a network telling me when to show up on set. I get to dictate how much I'm a mother. I have other obligations. And so it kind of allows me a lot more control. And so Bumble Pie, the name is actually a reference to a Canadian pie, Bumbleberry Pie, which is a mixed berry pie that I loved growing up. And it also sort of a reference to just bumbling through the universe, like not really knowing how we're going to get there, but figuring it out. And we made our first show for the Food Network called Star Plates in 2016. We have three shows at the moment in various stages of development, a competition show, a scripted show, and then another show in Canada, hopefully will be made in Canada. So some of them, I play a little role in front of the camera, but for the most part, I'm executive producing so that I can be a lot more creative and in the control room. And that's the meat of the work I love. And then there's also, other things like my book projects.
Well, and I love too that you just said, like, I didn't want to be like a slave to a network, and that you again have created your own destiny. You are a mom. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you have two beautiful children. And I want to just say and point out, because I know I talked about it in the beginning, you are the most normal person.
Ask my husband.
That,
he might not agree.
I come across a lot of people that are in the public eye all the time. And you are very humble. You are so normal. I so enjoyed spending the day with you when we were in New York. And
ditto.
And, I want the people listening to understand that. And so my question for you about this is, how do you maintain your normalcy? You are living in a world where you are so normal. You have kids, you are a mom, you have the same mom problems that we all do.
You're
jetting off to Aspen and you're jetting off to,
I think I maintain it the same way we all do, truthfully. And part of it is understanding that my situation isn't unique in a lot of ways. Like, and I say that meaning every parent has the same issues, whether you have a ton of money or no money, whether you are traveling for your job or working from home, whatever situation, you still have to raise your children, give them a foundation, be there, show up. There's certain ways that have made it easier. I'm lucky that I have great support. I have a husband who is like a 100% partner, in our child rearing. He doesn't need to travel. He used to travel a lot more for his work. He doesn't anymore. So he can actually do his work remotely from a lot of places, which allows us freedom for my travel. So that's been very lucky, but also, I don't know, I want my kids to have the same childhood or a similar childhood as much as possible as I did. And I think about the way I was raised with my parents, like they had challenges as well, of course, but I don't know. I just think that being around is really important and exposing your children to as much as possible is important too. My kids come with me a lot, not always. I sort of have this rule of like, if I travel for under 3 days, 4 days max, I go alone. But if it's more than that, I try to figure out how to bring them. Now they're older and that's harder. But the good news is Top Chef in particular, because I travel for about 8 weeks every year just to make that show alone. We shoot partially over the summer, so they're able to join me. My kids have been on set every year of their lives except one COVID year. One COVID year, they literally lived for 10 weeks with us in Portland, Oregon. The next COVID year of the show, they stayed home with my husband and I came back a little bit. The whole thing is a jigsaw puzzle. There's no normal. I just feel like, I don't know. I am not an expert in parenting. We're all just trying to do it. And also just in navigating the challenges of life in general. I don't know. I love that I love my job. That doesn't mean that it's all awesome. It's still called work for a reason, right? I make it sound like very glamorous, but I assure you, I'm not just like going to 12-course tasting menus and jetting to Aspen every day. That's really not what my day-to-day looks like.
I know.
It stands to be said, because I think it's easy to get caught up in that part of it, but it's actually not the stuff that really matters to me. But I'm really lucky to be able to do it. so that I can then choose to be able to be home when I want to as well.
I know that your kids came with you to Milwaukee this summer. And so yes. I have to bring this up because I'm a Midwestern girl, and a lot of people who listen and who will be listening are from the Midwest. But tell us a little bit about your time in Milwaukee. I know you told me you really enjoyed it. And so I would love a little bit of insight into your summer in the Midwest.
I will admit that when I was told we were going to Milwaukee, I was a little apprehensive. I had never been to the city of Milwaukee. I'd been to Wisconsin. I'd been to Madison for a book tour. I'd been to Kohler for a food and wine festival a few times, but I'd never actually been in Milwaukee proper. And I couldn't really imagine that we were going to spend 8 weeks there. Actually, it ended up being about six because then we left and went, did our finale elsewhere. And we went to Madison for a week of it as well. But immediately I found it refreshing. The context of it was that the season before was our 20th anniversary season, and we shot in London and Paris, which was a total dream. Like, it was amazing. My kids came. My kids were living with us in London for a month. We went to Paris. We had this incredible opportunity to pretend that we lived in London. My daughter went to summer camp there. You know, it was like a dreamy situation. But it was a really challenging season to produce from the show perspective, because Top Chef doesn't exist in England. And so no one there really cares about us. In a good way, it was refreshing that we could be really anonymous, and also that we had to like work a little harder for them to like us. But it was a real challenge. Coming back to the States, going to Milwaukee, what I love about the show is that every season of Top Chef, we're able to go to a different part of the world, part of the country, part of the world, and explore that world through the lens of food. And it had occurred to us that we hadn't been in the Midwest since season four in Chicago. And Chicago, arguably, you know more than anyone, as much as it's the Midwest, it's like this massive urban city. It's not necessarily indicative of the rest of the Midwest. And that was 2009 when we shot there. And here we are in 2024. So it was great, first of all, to explore that piece of the country in a way that we've never done before. There is so much to learn. But also to go back to a small city, a city that I have never known more eager, dedicated fans of Top Chef in my life. They welcomed us. They opened the city to us, the mayor, the tourism board, the chef community, which is really beautiful and lovely. And we got to know so many of the great chefs of Milwaukee, and the immigrant communities that really shaped the way that city eats, from German to Laotian to Serbian and Mexican. I mean, we had great food and a really diverse, interesting chef community that reached out to us and welcomed us. And it's a beautiful time of year to be there. So we were on the lake. We got to do a lot of exploring, check out farms and produce and baseball games. And it was also just a really easy city to live in. Like, unlike London, that is more like New York, the traffic, the subway navigation, the expense. I loved being in Milwaukee, where the traffic was easy to navigate. The people were welcoming. The Midwest lives up to the hype in that sense.
Thank you. I'm so glad you said that. I'm so glad that you had fun while you were here.
Yeah.
I have two quick last questions that I want to ask you. The first one is something you brought up at lunch when we were talking a few weeks ago when we were together. We were talking about social media, and you said, you know, I'm not really like so good at social media. I don't like going on social media. And you said, but I know that if I were doing more on social media, I could open myself up to more opportunities. And my question to you on that is, do you want more? I mean, your plate is so full, and it is. Like,
when I say more, that doesn't necessarily mean taking on double. It means, you know, the goal in life, and this is always hard, this is like the truth of business, is that the goal of running a business, no matter how big or how small, right, is to do less for the most cost, right? It's not to do 100 things for $5, to do 5 things for $100.
Totally.
And look, if I could really commit to social media in a way that I see so many, you know, influencers of my generation and many generations, you know, younger than me, posting every day, doing more content. Like, if I had the stamina to extend that about myself, make it more personal, you know, really like, do I know I could have more followers, we all know the game, right? More followers leads to more offers and opportunities and a wider reach and a broader audience. And so that with that comes different opportunities, perhaps bigger opportunities. But I also, I'm not complaining about what I have. Like, yes, if we all, and I'm not saying me alone, like if all of us spent all our time posting a lot more, thinking about it at all hours, day and night, which some people are really good at doing, we could all have more followers. We could all be bigger. I just can only sort of manage the balance of my mental health, my family, my real life, my IRL, you know, versus the time I spent taken away from that real life. And I need to find that balance. We all need to find that balance. We all know the outcome could be greater, but also there's a sinister element to it of it just absorbing you, and that it's not real life. And I still believe in real life. You know, I still believe, and I still also believe in longer format journalism, whether it's television or, you know, like other projects, book projects, even online, like writing. I still love that format versus the 6-second hack. That's just not who I am.
Well, I appreciate that. And that's why I asked you that question. I had a feeling the answer.
It's a hard balance.
Yes.
And I think we all struggle, especially as entrepreneurs, when you know that it's all up to you. Like your name is hanging on the shingle, right? When you're an entrepreneur and you have a brand that, as much as that gives you more freedom to create that brand and not answer to kind of higher ups in the boardroom, it also puts way more pressure on you to, because it's all up to you. It's what you make of it, right? Yeah. If you're out there, if I was out every single night going to every restaurant opening and every food event and every festival around the country, and of course I could be doing tons more. But, you know, and as a founder and as an entrepreneur, that's a lot of pressure, and I feel it and I see it. And I think we all do, whether we're trying to promote a brand or a whatever it may be. But I just think that there also has to like be balance in life, and you can't do it to your own detriment.
I appreciate that so much. Before I ask my final question, I do want to give you a chance to plug the brand new book, The Top Chef Season 21.
Top Chef right now, Season 21 in Milwaukee's on the air. It airs every Wednesday at 9 Eastern, 8 Central. Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
And it's amazing. And it was so much fun. And I think that we show off Wisconsin in the best way, and we'll do more when that's done. We start shooting again over the summer.
And it is so much fun. We've watched every single episode, and we've loved every single one. So I want to wrap up on the same note that I wrap up with everyone on. And that is, what are 3 actionable items, steps that you would give to someone who's starting their own business?
I think it's valuable to not have a perfect plan. I don't believe in the 5-year plan, because inevitably the world will trip it up. You don't know where the world will be in 5 years. So how can you possibly know where you will be? I always say, like, have the foresight to walk ahead confidently, but make sure to keep looking to the left and the right, because that's where the opportunities are. They're never straight ahead. It's never a straight line. There's always going to be some zigzagging, and you have to be open to those doors as they become available to you. And I would say, stay true to, like, you know, your own instinct. That's the most valuable tool you have, as an entrepreneur, that you need, you know, whatever you're setting out to do, even if you don't know exactly what it's going to look like in the future, you know, the values of your company, the values of who you are, and finding that balance of who you are and what your goals are, I think, early on, and referring back to them often, even if the path changes, I think is really important. And finally, I don't know, don't take yourself so seriously. Everyone, like, you're not so special. Everybody in the best way. Like, I think humility is really important, and being able to laugh at yourself and your mistakes and know that everyone else out there is just trying their best to do the same, is a lesson I repeat to myself often. That way I don't get too caught up if things don't exactly work out, or if I'm not doing as much as the people around me. Like, comparing myself is just a fruitless endeavor, and it will never get you anywhere because you're your own individual.
Thank you so much for saying that. Gail Simmons, culinary expert, food writer, and dynamic TV personality. Thank you so much for being on Dear Founder and for sharing your story with us. I am so excited to share this with our community.
Thank you so much. I love talking to you.
In case you missed it, we close out every episode with our number one takeaway from our conversation. My takeaway from Gail is not to have a perfect five-year plan. Life will get in your way, and you have to know when to pivot to embrace what it throws at you. With that comes the notion of keeping your eyes open to new opportunities. They're not always in front of you, which is why you have to be looking for them. I want to thank Gail so much for joining us today. This conversation is certainly one of my favorites. We've been getting so much love for season 3 of Dear Founder, and you have all been so gracious with your time leaving us some amazing reviews. LB Legal Creative recently wrote, "Lindsay is a natural and I love listening to her podcast. What makes her so good is that she truly listens and responds to the things her guests say. It's an actual conversation." So if you liked today's discussion, I would love it if you left a 5-star rating and a review so that others can find us. All you have to do is go to ratethispodcast.com/dearfounder or click the link in the show notes to leave a review wherever it is that you podcast. And if you know someone who we should meet, send them our Meet a Founder link in the show notes. We'll introduce them to our community on our social media and our website later this year. But for now, I want to thank you for listening and thank you for being here. Have a great rest of the week, and we will see you on Thursday.